This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Search no evil? Uncle Sam wants to know who's looking for internet porn, but Google says no way. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Google, the internet search giant whose corporate motto is Don't Be Evil, is defying a Justice Department subpoena to turn over records on millions of its users' search queries. The government wants to protect children from online pornography. Google says the search information is private. But how private is it? How much do search engines really know about their users, and what right does the government have to know it? On Reporter's Notebook, later on, a new twist in the never-ending tale of the Balkans, Kosovo's president has died. All that on To the Point. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney today, back with To the Point from PRI. We'll be talking about Google's refusal to supply the Justice Department with information about millions of search queries by its users. The government is trying to protect children from internet pornography, but is its request a fishing expedition that opens the door to more invasive searches of consumer web surfing? How much do search engines know about their users? What limits should there be on the kind of information they collect? On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Kosovo's president died over the weekend, just as talks were about to begin to determine the final status of the province, which has been governed by the United Nations since 1999. First, this news update. Ford Motor Company announced today that it will cut up to 30,000 jobs in North America, nearly a quarter of its workforce in the region. Ford also said it will close 14 plants in North America. The overhaul of its operations is aimed at reviving the company's auto sales. My guest today is Chris Woodyard. He's the auto writer for USA Today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sarah.
Let's listen first, Chris, to a soundbite from Bill Ford, CEO, at today's press conference.
By taking the actions we are today, in the long run, we will create far more stable and secure jobs. We all have to change, and we all have to sacrifice. But I believe this is the path to winning.
Exactly what is there to be won? What does he mean by that statement?
Well, he sounds like he's trying to reposition the company. This is a company that's been doing okay around the world, but it's been losing a lot of money in the United States and North America, about $1.5 billion last year. So really what he's trying to say is we're going to cut our capacity, we're going to cut our manufacturing capacity by 25%, but we're also going to try to reposition our car line so people will want to buy them again.
In what terms of repositioning the car line? Ford has been sort of famous for its SUV sales in recent years.
And that's been killing them lately because people aren't buying SUVs anymore because of the gas costs. So what he was trying to say today is that they're going to try to get more people interested in cars and what they call crossover vehicles. They've been doing great selling Mustangs and a new midsize vehicle called the Fusion, but no one's buying anything else.
Well, what about the timing of the announcement? Ford actually had profits last year of some $2 billion, and yet it's saying it has to cut the jobs of nearly 30,000 workers to become profitable in this arm of its operations.
And, Sarah, that's going to make it a tough sell with the UAW, I think. The quick answer for them is, of course, we've been doing okay around the world, but you just can't keep going when you have this kind of hole in your core market, which is the United States.
And what exactly does the United Autos Auto Workers Union have to do with what Ford wants to do? What do they have to approve or not approve? What control do they have?
Well, you know, these days, whether it's General Motors or Ford, the contracts are such that the two companies are very closely intertwined. And in some cases, Ford and General Motors have to pay workers even after they're laid off. And, of course, they have massive health care costs that go with this as well. So it's a very delicate balance for these automakers.
And if Ford is doing well, as it is in other parts of the world, if it's come on strong in Europe and Latin America, what is the problem exactly with its North American operations? Is it these healthcare costs? Is it the change in the auto buying market?
It's all of the above, and particularly, as you just said, the change in the auto buying market. I mean, these companies would be doing just fine if people wanted to buy their products. But right now, they're getting hit from every direction. The imports, particularly the Japanese and Asian brands, have a wonderful quality mantra that goes with them. And now they have a wonderful fuel-saving mantra that goes with them. And also, even though they've improved the quality of their products quite a bit, both Ford and GM still lag in customer perception that their cars are going to last as long as the other guys.
What can Ford bring from its overseas operations? I mean, obviously it doesn't sell American-sized cars in Europe. It has a different line there.
Well, it's bringing a lot of brain power. I mean, they have some very smart executives that have been running those operations. And one of the things they said today was that they're going to try to be building more cars off the same platforms. So in other words, if you're building a car in Europe or a car in Asia, you'll be able to use the same underpinnings of that car to build a Ford or a Mercury or a Lincoln in this country.
Ford restructured almost 4 years ago, almost to the day, and cut 20,000 jobs then. What's the relationship of today's restructuring to what happened with Bill Ford back in 2001?
Well, it's very interesting. In 2001, Bill Ford took over the company at a time when it was just flat on its back. That's when the whole, Explorer, Firestone tire situation was going on, where there was a lot of accidents and a lot of bad publicity. And he created a restructuring program at that time. But he said today that, we did as well as we could with that, but we have to go a lot farther. And they just can't keep these sustained losses in North America, is what they said.
And what about the laid-off workers? You mentioned that the Ford may have to pay them for quite a while to come. Is there actually a benefit to Ford in cutting these jobs?
Well, absolutely. I mean, they have to cut their manufacturing capability, even though it could incur some huge costs. And they're taking, between the closing of the facilities and the workers being, in some cases, laid off, but in a lot of cases, they'll be going through attrition. But they're taking $500 million in costs just in 2006 alone to try to accomplish that.
And just briefly, will Ford be bringing more hybrid vehicles on the market?
Absolutely. They said today they're going to announce four new hybrids to market by 2010.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Woodyard is the auto writer for USA Today. I'll be back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
I'm Sarah Terry, back with To the Point. The Justice Department has subpoenaed four internet search giants for information on what users search for on the web. And only Google has said no to Uncle Sam. The government has asked for the information as part of its efforts to try to protect children from online pornography, a booming internet business. But privacy advocates worry that the request may set a precedent for more invasive Big Brother-type demands. What's at stake in the showdown between the Justice Department and Google? How much information do search engine companies really have on their consumers? And how should the government try to enforce laws aimed to protect minors online? My first guest is Danny Sullivan. He's the editor of SearchEngineWatch.com, an online industry newsletter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
First, let's sort of lay out the context in which this has taken place. The subpoenas were actually issued last August.
That's correct.
And what exactly was laid out in those requests from the government?
The government originally seemed to have asked for all the URLs or all the web pages that a search engine made accessible to their users, as well as all the searches that were done from a period of 2 months, June 1st through July 31st, which is a lot of information.
Yeah. Who'd have time to read it, what I'd think.
It would be interesting to see if they could even send it to them electronically with the information.
And but they've actually asked for what it's at issue now is searches made over the course of a one-week period and not with the actual names of the people doing those searches.
That's right. They whittled it down to saying to Google, in particular, we'll be happy if you can just give us a week's worth of searches and also a million URLs randomly pulled from your database. And in no time do they seem to have asked for personally identifiable information. They haven't wanted to know who it was that was actually doing these kinds of searches in any way.
The four companies involved are Google, MSN, Yahoo, and America Online. Give us sort of a brief overview of how each has responded.
Well, Google has said no, and they're fighting the battle. That's what happened last week, and why it all came out is that it was actually a case then filed to force them to hand over this information. The others have all complied in various ways. They have either handed over whatever it was that was requested, or that they've handed over some type of information to the degree that the Justice Department doesn't decide that it needed to sue them.
Did Google do the right thing in saying no?
I believe so.
Why?
The information that they've asked for was very broad. It was a ton of information, and the precedent of asking for that much information and that much overkill just first and foremost makes you want to push back on it.
There just because it was so broad, you mean, in terms of what they were looking for?
Exactly. You can add on to that the fact that the information won't actually help them do what they say they're trying to do.
Why not?
You can't tell, for example, one of the things they're trying to identify is how likely a child might encounter pornography. So if you've asked for the search data, ironically, without any information as to who's doing the searching, then you don't know the user behavior of children. You don't know what it is that children are actually searching for so that you can measure that kind of behavior. They haven't done things such as they didn't request the removal of what are known as automated queries or automated searches, where somebody might run the same search 20 times a day using software. People do that to understand how pages are ranked in the search engines. That could make you think that there's actually more porn queries than there perhaps are actually going on. That's not necessarily key to this. It isn't really about how much porn searching activity happens, but the idea is that, well, we just get all this search data, we know searcher behavior. If you don't take out that kind of automated query, then you don't really know searcher behavior.
In terms of the growth of the Internet and the issue of government involvement or invasion of Internet use, is this an unprecedented request?
Did you say, it's unprecedented to my knowledge in terms of search engines.
Is there anything comparable that the government has asked for? This is obviously a growing field with lots of new questions being asked all the time.
Yeah, there's nothing like it that I can recall. We don't have access to every kind of subpoena that the government may or may not have made. There may have been stuff that has been requested and has never come to the light of day. This is, if you talk about the public stuff that we do know about, there's nothing like this.
And the next step in the case will be what? A judge will be ruling on the government's request?
That's right. They'll review the evidence, apparently, and decide whether or not they think Google should be forced to hand over this information.
Any idea on when we can expect that judgment?
I believe it may be something that actually doesn't come up for trial for about 2 or 3 months, but I don't recall the timing top of my head for certain.
Okay, thank you. Let's bring another guest into the conversation. Keely Knipling is the Associate Counsel at the National Law Center for Children and Families. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
What is your organization's perspective on this issue about the government asking for this search inquiry information?
The National Law Center supports the government's efforts to defend COPPA. We think that COPPA...
Let's explain that.
That's okay.
That's the Children's Online Protection Act, which is designed to keep children from getting access to Internet porn sites.
Yes, it's the underlying case that they have used to
bring the subpoenas.
Uh-huh. Correct. So we support any efforts to defend COPPA. We believe it's a constitutional way to protect children from material that would be harmful to them.
Let's talk about COPPA for just a few moments. In 2004, the U.S. Supreme Court said it's a 1998 law. It said the law could not be enforced unless the government proved that it was the only practical way to shield minors from adult-oriented websites. So these subpoenas are growing from the government's attempt to prove that this is the only way it can be done?
I don't know that they have to prove it's the only way it can be done. It just must be narrowly tailored to a compelling interest, and it needs to be the least restrictive means. So if the government can prove that, as of right now, it's the least restrictive way to keep this material from children, it doesn't have to be the only way to keep material from children, but just the least restrictive under First Amendment case law.
What do you all know about how easy it is for children to get access to these sites?
From what we've heard, unfortunately, it's really quite easy for children to get access to websites that are harmful to them. The harmful to minors standard is a is a little bit different than the obscenity standard. It would include some material that is protected under the First Amendment, however, still would be considered harmful to minors. So,
and harmful to minors is defined as what?
It is defined, it's quite a lengthy definition.
Give it to us in sort of common everyday language.
Basically, if it's material that appeals to the prurient interest, which is also carefully defined in case law, but an interest in sometimes shameful or morbid sex. And also it would have to be a patently offensive display with respect to minors.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to, taken as a whole, lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors.
In the 1970s, there were a lot of court cases, a lot of big discussion over these issues, over prurient interests, over community standards of decency, in regards to where pornographic theaters and bookstores were placed. Is this sort of the new frontier in trying to determine these limits in society?
We think so. We just think that this is the Internet, while it is a wonderful medium, is not really that different than print or video mediums in the past. It's just a different way of delivering the same content. And it's been upheld, like you say, in the 70s in all those cases to regulate it in a print medium. So we feel that it would be just as appropriate to regulate it in the medium of the Internet.
We heard from Danny Sullivan, editor of SearchEngineWatch.com, however, that what the government has asked for in this case is fairly meaningless and useless because it doesn't tell you whether or not minors have had access to these sites.
Right, and I really can't speak to exactly how Professor Stark plans to use this information in his analysis. I'm not a statistician or anything like that, so I don't really understand exactly how he plans to use it.
He's the statistician from the Department of Justice?
Yes, he's the expert they have hired to...
Right, from UC Berkeley.
Right.
Okay.
To analyze this data that they hope to receive or that they already have received from three of the search engines.
So you're not sure how he can analyze it or whether or not, in fact, it's useful is what you're saying.
Right. I mean, we would argue that it is relevant because it does show usage of the Internet. You know, as to exactly how accurate it would be, that would go more towards the weight of the evidence question as opposed to relevance in court. So that would be more for the judge or jury to determine how much weight to put in that kind of evidence in the case, not whether or not it's admissible on relevance grounds.
Okay, let's take some of these legal questions to Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia Law School. He's co-author of Who Controls the Internet, a book to be released this March. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
What are the legal issues and how have they changed in terms of pornography and the government's right to control it and, in this case, to access the kind of information that the Justice Department has asked for?
Well, the law hasn't precisely changed. It's more the technology that's changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the First Amendment is the major limit on the government's power to control pornography, and it continues to be so. The only difference is that where they're trying to get their information from are completely different to prove this particular case is a new technology, obviously, the search engine.
And it's one of the things that came to my mind was the issue of, you know, a person who goes to a public library and makes searches through the card catalog or, you know, an old-fashioned thought perhaps. But librarians have been ferocious in fighting the government, most recently in sort of the post-2001 terrorism sort of searches and requests, in fighting the government's request to get this kind of information. Are there any similarities here?
Yeah, I think there's a lot. And I think there's an issue here that hasn't quite been brought up yet, which is, you know, there's one question as to whether or not the government needs this for this particular COPPA case that we discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But the other question is, why exactly is Google keeping all this and all the rest of the search engines? I mean, I love these search engines, but why are they keeping all of this inquiry data in the first place?
Good
and
question.
There are some technical reasons why these are useful, but I don't think a lot of Americans have realized. In fact, I didn't know, and I'm a pretty techie kind of person, that all those search engines, all those queries, you know, hundreds a day we might do for years and years and years, are all being kept in some log file somewhere.
So
I think that's news to a lot of people. Sorry.
I think it is, too. Each company has within its own archives or database somewhere all these millions upon millions of searches.
That's what we seem to be learning, and I'm sure that other people agree that sometimes things people search for can be embarrassing or private, and the news that these are all kept, moreover, coupled with IP addresses, is, I think, the real issue behind the story. I think the subpoena issue is transient. I think the real question here is for the record-keeping policies of the search engine companies.
And where does that conversation play out? Does it take a consumer rights group to bring a lawsuit? Does it take increased public awareness through the media? How does this conversation and how do its effects change?
I think this is the as I just said, that it's through conversations like this that people realize, in fact, that their search engine queries are being recorded, and a general consumer demand to basically not keep any identifying information. It's not necessarily so bad that they might keep the search queries. The real danger is when they keep information that's linked to you or me through our IP address, where it can get back to us. And the reason is that ultimately there's a lot to this freedom to search without being watched, and that's really what's at danger here.
Let's go back to Danny Sullivan, editor of SearchEngineWatch.com, with that question. That sense of anonymity in searching the Internet, that feeling that you can kind of go anywhere and look up anything and nobody's looking over your shoulder, it's kind of violated now, isn't it?
Yes, but it actually didn't really exist in the first place.
How do you mean?
Well, even if you take away the fact that the search engines have been watching and storing the data, your Internet service provider sees all that data that's going out as well. If you're doing it within your work, then your work is probably having a record of everything you've been going to and searching on. If you go to a website and you click on a link from a search engine, they know that you've come from that search engine, and they probably know what you've searched for as well. So I agree that a lot of people probably don't understand that kind of information is out there, if you will, and that's been sort of leaked in that way. And it's an excellent thing that this is raising that kind of awareness.
I don't think the average person actually knows, or perhaps you've sort of heard, oh, be careful, they can collect this information on you. But a lot of people just fill out those forms left and right about your preferences, where you live, what you do. Why do you think people are so free to give that information, or have been up until now?
In part because I think that they don't realize that information is being recorded in that way. You can even skip the whole thing as to whether or not they're filling out the form with their name, you know, their phone number and email address. Just say somebody going to Google or Yahoo and doing a search. That act of searching has recorded the information you've searched for, plus the computer that you did the search from. So there's already some information you've exposed. So, and part of it is also, I think, that there's some degree of trust that they trust these companies, and they're trusting the companies are probably not going to abuse the data.
And the reason these companies are compiling the data is it known? Is there speculation? Is it commercially driven in terms of being able to target advertising?
Well, yeah, and it can sound worse than it is in some ways. I mean, the idea that they're compiling the data and putting together a big profile on us is a bit different than what may be happening in terms of they've got this data, it's being stored somewhere, it may not even be online for anybody to access, but they haven't tossed it out necessarily. And there are degrees in terms of what they're doing. If you go to Google, for example, you can actually sign up for a service that they call search history. And not only will they track the searches you're doing, they'll show you that over time, and they'll use the searches that you're doing to change the queries that you do and give you better results. Anybody who's been to Amazon, for example, and has ever bought a book and then had Amazon suggest other books based on what you're doing, it's the same kind of thing, and that is coming more and more into search. That's one reason why they may keep this data and try to compile it with what you're doing, and there are good reasons for having that, but there are the dangers that go with it as well.
Okay, well, we're going to get back to that subject in just a few moments when we come back with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We've been talking about the Justice Department's subpoenas to four Internet search engines requesting millions of records about search queries made by consumers. It's raised questions about Internet privacy, about what the government can know or is trying to know. I'd like to go back to Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia Law School. Let's step out and broaden the picture a little bit in terms of this issue of governments and the Internet. What's the sort of global look at how governments are able to control or obtain information that comes from the Internet?
Yeah, this is what we're talking about here is a very small part of a much larger trend that we've seen develop and which we discuss a lot in our book. of governments seizing control of the internet again and taking asserting their power. And one thing I wanted to point out in context of this case is that many of the most controlling countries, China and Burma and so on, pay a lot of attention to search engines. Search engines really are the gateway to everything the internet can be in terms of a free forum for expression and so forth.
Well, it's almost like reading somebody's mind, isn't it? When you sort of can go, oh, so-and-so wants to know about this, 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 and this. It just lets you sort of have a portal right into what somebody's thinking.
Yeah, I know. I agree. Exactly. I think that some of the, in fact, I would put email at, sorry, search results at some of the most private thing. That's what I think this case, why this case really hits a nerve. People's search engines have become their confidants, and their deepest secrets are often revealed to them. So I think this is really the centerpiece or the gateway for a lot of internet freedoms. And I don't usually get that up in arms about these things, but this is an issue that I feel quite that I've felt is really at the center of things.
And in terms of you mentioned China and its more authoritarian approach to it, Burma, Vietnam, some of the communist countries there, obviously. Where would you position the United States today in light of this case involving Google and the Justice Department? At what point on the continuum does the U.S. stand in terms of the way the government is trying to control the internet?
Yeah, the United States is one of the freer places in the world still. Our obsessions tend to be with respect to intellectual property more than political freedom. But that seems to be changing. This is a precedent. We don't really know what's happening with the NSA and whether it has, as some people have, you know, discussed in rumors, no one really knows whether they've been interested in search engine results or emails.
Well, it does sort of resonate on a lot of levels, doesn't it, with that NSA eavesdropping on the unauthorized contended that it's unauthorized eavesdropping on American consumers. This is kind of a double blow coming in the space of a short period of time.
That's right. Now, that isn't this case. I think that's important. This is related to the, you know, this pornography legislation.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a wake-up call for the fact, and this is really not an issue about trusting Google or trusting AOL or Microsoft. It's an issue about them making secret material available. It's an issue of the fact that they ultimately have to obey government. And the scary thing about this is that government, they have what is effectively like a wiretap that's always on for search engine results. And the government's learning that it can tap into that. And that's why I think that something has to change pretty quickly.
Okay. That's Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia Law School, co-author of Who Controls the Internet, to be released this March. I'd like to bring Kurt Opsahl into the conversation. He's a staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, an online rights watchdog. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We've just heard Tim Wu outlining some somewhat chilling sort of points of view on what this case actually stands for. What do you say?
Well, I think he's raised some very good points. I mean, the search engines have massive databases that reach into the most intimate details of people's lives. What they're searching for can indicate what they read, what worries them, what they like, what they want to find out more about. And it's very important to protect the privacy of that information so people can take advantage of these necessary tools. They're tools that are necessary to navigate the web without the fear of Big Brother.
And in this case, with the Google and MSN and AOL and Yahoo, is it really the big deal that some people have sort of been making it into in terms of its invasiveness? Does it open the door that much wider to what the government could be asking for in the future?
Well, in this case, they have limited the request to, in the case of the searches, to the search string itself. However, over the weekend, Newsweek reported that a DOJ spokesperson said he would, quote, "I'm assuming that if something raised alarms, we would hand it over to the proper authorities." That is interesting because then they could go back to Google or back to Yahoo with a second subpoena saying, okay, we found this interesting search term. We want to find out who wrote that term.
Has anybody determined yet how usage of the internet or where does it fall under the Bill of Rights in terms of is it freedom of speech, freedom of the press? What kind of protections are afforded?
Absolutely. The First Amendment applies very strongly to the internet. As the Supreme Court recognized in the first major case about this, ACLU v. Reno.
What year was that?
That was in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
And they were dealing with the Communications Decency Act, another attempt to regulate indecent material on the internet. And in rejecting that attempt, the Supreme Court noted that the First Amendment absolutely applied to the Internet.
The issue of pornography online and pornography in communities, it's a long-standing battle. How do you balance the right of a society to want to protect its children from certain things against the right of an individual to the First Amendment rights we've been talking about?
Well, I think what's really coming up in this underlying case is whether you want to have parents have control by putting filtering software on their own computer to control what their children see, or whether you want to have the government mandating how the Internet should look so that everyone is forced to go to look at an Internet with the lowest common denominator.
What kind of filters are in place, and are they actually effective? I mean, the Internet porn sites often just say you have to check a box that says I'm older than 18 years old. That doesn't seem to be any great detractor.
Well, there are filtering softwares. A wide variety of private companies have come up with filtering softwares where they have block site lists. They have methodologies for coming up with sites that you cannot go through unless parental permission is put in. Also, within some of the search engines, if you go to Google, go through their image search, they have a safe search option, actually a low, medium, and high setting that will attempt to block out adult material.
Let's bounce this question over to Keely Knipling, Associate Counsel at the National Law Center for Children and Families, whose organization does not think the government is out of line in this current case with Google. What about it, Ms. Knipling? Is it possible to just, why aren't filters good enough?
Well, I think that's just a debatable point. We've heard from experts on both sides that say filters are just not adequate. They're easy to break. Kids are too tech-savvy. They're too easy to get around. You can give a 13-year-old a computer, and he can break your filter in 5 minutes. So that may or may not be true, but that's what the government has to prove in the case, and so they need this information to help them prove that.
What will be the most compelling argument the government can make, do you think?
Well, there are actually scientific studies, psychological studies coming out about the impact of this material on minors, and so we would argue that the more compelling the interest, then the easier it is for them to prove their case. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by your question.
You've answered it. That's exactly what I meant. Danny Sullivan, editor of SearchEngineWatch.com. In this case, with three companies having already agreed to the government's request, what does that do to Google? What into its standing and the argument that it's going to be making?
Into its argument that it shouldn't have to give the data over?
Yes.
Potentially, it makes it stronger. The data that they'd hand over is not going to be that significantly different than what they've already gotten. And in fact, by taking this long to drag things out even further, by the time they actually do the analysis, if they haven't done it already, they're going to be dealing with data that's a year old, and then you have the argument that, well, the data you've just presented is not even in current for what we're doing now. Really, they ought to just get on with analyzing what they've got and just give it up. More to the point, what they've got isn't going to help them analyze what they've requested isn't going to prove what they're thinking anyway. But you know, at least they've got enough data that they can get started.
From perhaps a more cynical point of view, what does Google stand to gain in all of this? Is it really, truly just an altruistic, we're committed to the rights of privacy, considering that, in fact, they've already got all that information on their consumers? Is it really committed to that, or is it a good sort of business move?
It's a good business move, and that was actually one of the reasons they said they weren't going to do it. They were asked for every URL that they have listed, and that's proprietary. If you give them every URL, then another search engine can take all that information if it leaks out or if it becomes public record, and then that may give them some idea. You have an idea of the number of queries that may happen per day. There are competitive reasons why they didn't want to release this information as well. You can certainly take the cynical view, and some will. I tend to think it's a mixture of both of those sorts of things, however.
Kurt Opsahl from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, what's your take on that? Is it just a good business move for Google, or are they really taking a stand here?
Well, Google has differentiated itself by this suit by saying they are more protective of users' privacy interests in their searches than the other search engines, and that has perhaps would cause some people to rather prefer to use Google if they're searching for something they might be embarrassed if it was revealed.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also, you know, as Danny points out, this is proprietary information that is of interest to Google's business. They don't want it to get out for that reason. And it's also part of Google's mantra, do no evil, as part of their corporate culture, or at least that's what they said when they went public. And this seems to be trying to push along those lines.
The don't do evil sort of being handing over the information would be an evil or a bad thing.
Well, certainly. This is very private information that people do not want to have the government snooping through.
But I'm curious. It's not okay for the government to have it, but it's okay for Google to have it?
Well, that's a good question. Why is Google carrying this much information? I mean, that was raised before. And in fact, a congressman said he was going to introduce legislation to limit the amount of data that search engines can collect. And how long they can keep it to a reasonable time.
So, that was Ed Markey, I think, Markey from Massachusetts,
who
introduced that, right? But, I mean, this is fairly unregulated territory, right, in terms of drawing any restrictions on Internet search companies and sort of saying you can have this but not that or for this long but not for longer?
Well, what Markey is proposing is using the standards of the Cable Act to regulate the privacy of search engines. As you may know, your viewing habits, what channels you watch on your cable system is highly protected information. So it would raise the search engine use to that same standard.
What about the average listener or an Internet user who's just perhaps for the first time over the weekend really kind of cottoned on to the fact that there's a lot of information about him or her that's been downloaded to a corporation somewhere? What are the things you can do to protect yourself, hide your identity, keep yourself secure from these kinds of intrusive things?
Well, there are technologies you can use to help protect your identity. There is an open source software called Tor that you can use to surf the web and mask your IP address.
Tor is, that's T-O-R, how would people find it?
T-O-R, tor.eff.org.
Okay. And you go through that to make an Internet search, is that it?
It's an onion router, so it moves your request through several different nodes before it reaches the Internet. Then it goes back through several different nodes before it gets to your computer.
Of going www.google.com and entering a search, I would go to tor.eff.
No, it actually would be software you download,
okay,
part of your browser, and then once it's installed, it would be transparent to you. You just type in the address as normal.
Oh, so I'd still be on whatever search engine I wanted to use, but...
But they wouldn't know who you were.
Okay.
You can also use commercial services like anonymizer.com. And then for a monthly or annual fee, they will anonymize your transactions, and you can go surf the web keep your identity a secret.
How many people use those services now, do you think? What percentage of the Internet-using public knows about them?
It's very low. I think people are not fully realizing how much information is being kept about them. And now as more of this comes to light and it comes into the public eye, people are getting worried. So perhaps these services will start to take off.
Well, how do you expect the conversation to sort of unfold in the month or two ahead as this case moves forward? Continued conversation about privacy or more of a focus on the government's request in this case?
Well, I think the government's request is an example of an overreaching request. It's somewhat unprecedented that they would seek this much information, especially when it is not directly for evidence, but rather to try and obtain a data set so they can mine that data and hopefully find evidence later. So it's pretty extraordinary. But it is part of seemingly a pattern of the government looking for very large data sets and then sifting through them to try and find out information about the people who participated in the activity.
What other parts of that pattern? This fits in with what other things would you hold up as an example?
Well, I mean, I think that you can look at it in the context of some of the wiretapping that has been revealed.
With the NSA, yeah.
With the NSA, with the Total Information Awareness Project that was proposed a couple years back and then shot down by Congress. Since then, there have been other data mining projects that have gone underway in with the IRS and the DOD. And it seems to be that there's a administration that thinks it's a good idea to gather a lot of information and then sift through it. But when you take a look at things like your Amazon, what other things you might enjoy or the suggestions that TiVo makes,
mm-hmm.
It's not always the case that these computerized analysis of what you're looking at yields a correct assumption about what you'll be looking at in the future that really understands who you are. And it worries me that some of these data mining programs might also make false assumptions and subject people to further scrutiny based on innocuous behavior.
So if you were to step back and try to put this in context, at what point are we in this sort of development of the Internet and right to privacy and the government's right to control it? At the beginning of the sort of battle or well into it and we just haven't noticed?
Well, you know, the Internet started out as being a very free, open, and libertarian technology that was very difficult to control. Not like the cable system, where there's central points that can be controlled, but it goes peer-to-peer, very difficult for governments to step in and take a look at that individual aspects of the Internet. It routes around censorship, and this made it very difficult for the government to control. And as it tries to come in and sort of re-engineer the Internet to put in more points of control, it's finding some difficulties. And one way to try and do that is look at private entities that are potentially those points. When you have large companies that gather huge amounts of data about many, many users, it gives them a central point to look at that they didn't have previously.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we've got for today for the conversation. Thanks so much for joining us. That was Kurt Opsahl, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We were also joined by Danny Sullivan, editor of SearchEngineWatch.com, Keely Knipling, associate counsel at the National Law Center for Children and Families, and Tim Wu, professor of law at Columbia Law School. A new challenge in the Balkans. Kosovo's president, who led a nonviolent campaign of resistance against the Milosevic regime in Serbia, died over the weekend, just as talks were about to begin on the final status of the province. We'll be back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The Balkans lost an important leader over the weekend. Ibrahim Rugova, the president of Kosovo, died on Saturday after a months-long battle with lung cancer. A writer and literature professor, Rugova was widely admired for his commitment to nonviolent change in a region that's known more than its share of violence. Rugova's death comes at a crucial time in the Balkans. Talks were just about to begin to determine the final status of the province, which has been governed by the United Nations since 1999. My guest is Tim Judah, a freelance journalist based in London who covered the wars in the Balkans. He is also the author of The Serbs, History, Myth, and the Destruction of Yugoslavia, and Kosovo, War and Revenge. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hello.
Tell us a bit more about Ibrahim Rugova and the role that he played over the past decade or so in the Balkans.
Well, he was born in 1944, and in the 70s he went to study in Paris under Roland Barthes. He was a literature and linguistics professor, and in the late 1980s, as Yugoslavia began to collapse, he became the leader of a new party called the Democratic League of Kosovo, which went on to become the most important party in the province of some 2 million people, of whom about 90% are ethnic Albanians. As Yugoslavia disintegrated, he led, as you say, a campaign for independence, but he was against using violence, and that's where he gained much kudos.
He was a literature professor, a writer. How was he as a politician?
Well, he was a shrewd politician, but he wasn't always on top of the game. He was undoubtedly the right man in the right place at the right time from the end of 1989, when he became the leader of the LDK, the Democratic League of Kosovo, until about 1998, when the war began, at which point he found himself a little... bypassed. People who opposed his stance against violence began an uprising. That was the Kosovo Liberation Army. And for the next couple of years, it looked as though Rugova's day was over. During the war, which culminated in NATO's 78-day bombing of Serbia and what remained of Yugoslavia, Rugova was discredited. He was forced, first he was put under house arrest, then he was forced to appear on television with Mr. Milosevic, the Serbian leader, and then he went into exile in Italy. And when he came back, it was assumed, more or less by everybody, that his day was over. But then a kind of very curious thing happened. His popularity began to grow once more. And what was rather odd was that Mr. Rugova realize that he didn't really have to say or do anything for his popularity to grow. It grew again because many of the former KLA leaders, on closer inspection immediately after the war, appeared to many Kosovars as rather thuggish and violent. And many of Mr. Rugova's party members or activists began to be assassinated. So his popularity grew in a rather odd way by him doing absolutely nothing.
Because there was at that time a lot of part of the issue, of course, in the beginning of that war with Kosovo had been the earlier war in Bosnia and Herzegovina, where Muslims were the victims in that war of an aggression. The NATO stepped in earlier rather than later, as it had done later in Bosnia, and it appeared that the Muslims were the victims, and yet. As you were mentioning with the KLA, there was then a lot of violence, a lot of reaction against Kosovo's Serb population. So he was a leader at a time when there had been violence sort of as a reaction back against the violence that had happened to Muslims.
Well, against Albanians in the case of Kosovo. I mean, the fact that the most Albanians in Kosovo are Muslims is in a way rather irrelevant because Albanians and Kosovo Albanians are also Orthodox and are also Catholic. But you're right. I mean, one of the things that is not being said at this time of obituaries and praise for Mr. Rugova is that in a way he was a president and a leader, but only of Kosovo's Albanians. He was really not interested at all in Kosovo's minorities, and in the wake of the war, when he returned and when he was duly elected president again in 2002, he never spoke up for the persecution of Kosovo's Serbs and other minorities, Roma especially, and he never extended the hand of reconciliation. So you are right to point that out.
There are about 100,000 Serbs in Kosovo today, is that right?
There are estimated to be about 100,000 Serbs remaining in Kosovo out of a population which is estimated at about 2 million, yes.
Who speaks for the Serb population in Kosovo today?
Well, there are several Kosovo Serb leaders, and of course they also regard the government of Serbia as their government. They say that Kosovo is part of Serbia, and technically speaking, it still is part of Serbia.
It is a region, for those who don't have it in their mind, within Serbia itself.
Yes, I mean, if we go back, I mean, to in the old Yugoslavia, which broke up, of course, in 1990-1991, Serbia was one of six republics, and Kosovo was an autonomous part of Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other republics have, of course, gone their own way, apart from Montenegro, which will probably secede in a few months' time. But Kosovo's status was somewhat different. It was not a republic. And Serbia claims that it is still the legal owner of Kosovo, even though 90% of its population are in favor of independence. Now, as you said in the introduction, talks on the future of Kosovo, more than 6 years after the end of the war, were due to begin in Vienna on Wednesday. Now, they've been postponed, but I think it's fairly clear that they will lead to some form of independence, probably in the first instance, what's called conditional independence, which is really code for a transitional phase before full independence.
Let's talk about those talks for just a moment. Rugova wasn't to be part of the negotiating team. He had appointed it. So his death doesn't change who's on that team. But give us a little bit more of that context. The international community seems to be wanting to push Kosovo towards some kind of independence or to have make the road work to get there against what Serbia would prefer to have happen, which would to give it some kind of autonomy, but not independence.
Just one slight correction. I mean, mm-hmm. Mr. Rugova, he would have been on the team.
Oh, I'm
absolutely.
Sorry.
And very importantly, he would have been the leader of the negotiating team.
Ah.
Now, although the other people in the team won't change, there is now a very big question about who will be the leader of the team. And that, you know, sorting that out is going to be quite a difficult political issue. Now,
is there a possibility that it would have a huge impact on the talks themselves? Would sort of a more rhetorical person become leader of the team, or a better negotiator?
Well, you could, if one wants to go into details. What the problem is that Mr. Rugova, as president, is now replaced anyway in the interim by the Speaker of Parliament, a man named Nedjad Dadzi. Mr. Rugova, by virtue of being the president, was the leader of the team.
Mm-hmm.
The others, many of the others on the team, do not like Mr. Darcy at all, and at least one of them, Veton Saroy, who is probably the most skilled of those people on the team, one of the most skilled people when it comes in terms of diplomacy and negotiations, has already said that if Mr. Darcy is the head of the team, he won't be on the team. So it's possible that there could be serious repercussions.
And let's step back a bit from these talks, which will go on when they'll start in a few months and go on for a bit, and just get a broader context for the Balkans today, which was in such tumult in the 1990s. Can you just sort of lay out a bit of the roadmap for us in the decade ahead for a region that has just been beset by cycles of violence?
Well, I mean, if you look at...
Sorry, we've only got about 30 seconds.
This year is a crucial year, and it will really be part of the end of, not those cycles of violence, but the end of that chapter of history. The state of Serbia and Montenegro will probably disappear in a few months. There'll be two new states there, Serbia and Montenegro, and most likely a third, Kosovo. Having said that, in the long run, the whole region is moving slowly, but I think surely, towards the European Union and towards European integration.
Thanks.
So in the long run, it's more optimistic than you might otherwise be led to believe.
Thanks for talking to us. Tim Judah is the author of The Serbs and Kosovo, War and Revenge. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. Join us again for To The Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To The Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.